I'm Dr. Malka Simkovic. I'm very happy to be with you today. Many of you are very familiar faces. Some of you are new faces. You should be able to access today's source sheet on the Tour in Motion website. But if not, I will be sharing my screen. I try to do that. Thank you, Mark, for showing the source sheet that you printed out. So you get extra credit for that. If you've taken my class before, you know that I really don't like to share my screen. I'm very selfish with my screen because I like to see you and I want you to see me. But I will begrudgingly share my screen in case, for whatever reason, you do not have access to that online source sheet, or you can figure it out. I also would appreciate it if someone actually could take the link of that source sheet and put it into the chat. That might be a good solution. This is not a big deal. If you accessed the source sheet more than 5 minutes ago, your order of sources will be a little different. It was just updated on the website, but your order of sources will be a little different than mine, and that's absolutely fine. And I'll clarify as we go along where our orders diverge. So let's get started, because I always find myself strained for time. As you know, again, if you've taken my classes, I always ambitiously put more in the source sheet than we can cover. So we'll just dive right in. And again, feel free to put your questions into the chat. And hopefully at the end of the hour, I will be able to make some time for conversation questions. All right. Judaism is often critiqued as an orthopraxic religion and not a religion of orthodoxos. These are Greek words, and orthopraxis from the Greek orthos and praxis refers to doing rather than believing. Doxos is the Greek word for believe, and praxis, of course, is related to the English word today, practice. And often observant Jews are criticized for, I think, falsely and unfairly criticized for highlighting ritual, practice, action, law, rather than an internalized dimension, a dimension that is emotional and that is highlighted by faith and feeling. But the truth is that the Torah does mandate our feelings. And very recently, we read Parshat Amor, we read about the holidays, and the Torah is very clear in Sefer Vayikra that holidays, and in that particular case, Sukkot, does include an emotional dimension to it. And in fact, this emotional dimension, I think, is more striking and counterintuitive than the mandated ritual that accompanies with it. Telling us to feel a certain way is, you know, giving us a very big job. It's easier to just do, right? Na'aseh v'nishma, it's easier to do. And then afterwards, maybe to internalize the emotional aspect to the ritual. But the Torah does mandate feelings. We're, again, supposed to feel joyous on Sukkot. And we're, I think, supposed to, as we enter into this time of Shavuot, also supposed to be in a celebratory mindset. We just celebrated Lag BaOmer. And so today I'm going to ask the question, according to Torah sources and according to early Jewish sources, what are Jews supposed to feel? And to whom are they meant to direct these feelings? And in the Torah, we do have interpersonal human relationships where husbands love wives and wives love husbands. Sometimes the object of their love is interested in somebody else. Very famously, Rachel and Yaakov and Leah, but also Michal and David might be another example. But in any case, we do have spouses who love or do not love their spouses. But we're never mandated. We are not required by the Torah to love spouses or children or siblings or even parents. Who are we required to love? There are two entities in the Torah that we are required to love. And I think both of these loves are counterintuitive. They're not natural. They're not organic to us. The first is, of course, God. We are required to love God with all of our being, all of our soul. This is what we affirm every time we say the Shema. It's in our liturgy. It's in Devarim. But we're also required to love the ger. This word ger is very hard to translate. I don't think that stranger is a great translation. Maybe I'll say sojourner. But I think most of this hour, I'll just stick to the Hebrew ger. We could talk about the options of how to translate this word, maybe if you're interested at the end of the hour. But what does it mean to love the ger? And what does it mean to love God? So today I'm going to begin with some sources in the Torah that interconnect these kinds of love. And we're going to see that, again, both of these loves are not intuitive, right? We are hardwired to fear a deity that can punish us if we disobey. And we might also be hardwired to stay away from outsiders who might threaten the stability and the continuity and safety of our community. But both of these loves, the ger love and the God love, really have to do with a covenantal relationship between Israel and God. We are given reasons for both of these loves, and both of those reasons have to do with gratitude that we are supposed to have for the God of Israel. And if you were to look at ancient Near Eastern sources, there's some really nice articles about this online. I actually just saw one recently by Dr. John Levinson on thetorah.com, who talks about the love of God as it is mandated in the Torah versus ancient Near Eastern sources. And there are some interesting parallels between the ways that we are supposed to love God and be devoted to God and other ancient texts about how one is supposed to be emotionally devoted to a king or a human ruler. But of course, God is so much more than a human ruler. God is the creator. God is the all-powerful. And so I'm going to share, reluctantly as always, I'm going to share my screen. Please note that I will not be looking at the chat. Please be patient. We have barely just started this talk, so I'm not going to be looking at the chat. If you could hold off on your comments and questions, unless it's a question of clarity and I went too fast or you need me to repeat something, then please just jump in. But questions and comments, I am very confident that some of these questions will be addressed over the course of the hour. So maybe we could hold off a little bit on those comments. And so right now I'm going to share my screen. Okay. Let's do this. Now I need a few seconds. And I never know, am I showing you my notes or the Sershi? Oh, you probably see my notes right now. Do you? I don't know what you see. Do you see love instructions in the Torah? This is the I think I did it right. This is Sershi?
You did it right.
Thank yes, you. We Thank see you. It.
Whoever said that. Okay. All right, good. So now I have to get my face out of the way. All right. So what we have here, and we're not going to do all of these inside, but we have a series of injunctions from Shemot and Devarim where it's very clear to us that the kind of love that the people of Israel are supposed to feel for God is a love that is mutual. If you love God, God will love you. God who loves you expects your love, right? So this is very explicit in the Aseret HaDibrot when we're told, right? Don't serve other gods. Only be loyal to me because this I, the true God, is Oseh Chesed Alafim Le'ohavai L'Shomrei Mitzvotai. So I do Chesed. This is another word that's very hard to translate. Some say loving kindness, but Chesed has a connotation of loyalty, of fealty, of mutuality. And this kind of mutuality, is really at the heart of this love relationship, right? So because God took you out of Egypt and God nurtured this relationship, you are essentially forever indebted, not only to obey God, but to feel something for this God. Now, the love for the ger is a little different because in the relationship with the ger, there really is no mutuality, by which I mean there's no expectation on the ger. There's no burden placed upon the ger to love the Israelite back. We must love the ger. The ger does not have to love us, but the reasons that we are mandated to love the ger are the same reasons that we're mandated to love God. And that is, it goes back to Egypt, right? So why do we love the ger? Because we remember how God loved us when we were gerim, right? Vahavtem et ager ki gerim heitim be'eretz Mitzrayim. So in both kinds of love, really, we're affirming the covenantal relationship by engaging in an emotional connection that is counter intuitive. Now, again, they're very different because in the love for God, in that relationship, we are responding to God's choosing us. We are objects being acted upon. We are receiving the covenant and we respond with love. But our love for the ger is empowering. We take the initiative. We're the powerful party. The ger has no obligation to us, but we initiate this relationship. We initiate this emotional dimension of that connection. So if you look at some of these sources, I'm not going to do these inside, but you'll see both of these themes, reasons to love the ger are the same reasons to love God, which is that it goes back to God choosing the people of Israel in a moment of mysterious and inexplicable love. And so in Vayikra Yotet, we're told the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamach Mochad is actually very interesting because it sort of expands this, that not only do you have to love every ger, but you have to love every person. And the reason is sort of strange. When I highlight, oh no, you don't see, I thought I was scrolling down in the source sheet, I was scrolling down in my notes. I'm sorry about that. All right. So if you look at in Vayikra, you'll see Ke'ezrach Mikem Yelechem Ager, Hager Yitzchem, V'Ahavta Lo Kamocha, you should love the ger as yourself, but not merely that, you should love all people as yourself. Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, we talk about that all the time, but we forget how deeply connected it is to this theme that's highlighted dozens of times in the Torah, which is the Ahavta Et Hager, to love the ger. Why? Because Kigirim Hatim Be'eretz Mitzrayim. And over and over in Vayikra Yotet, you have a refrain, you have a sort of chorus. And that, when I highlight, you can see that, right? And the chorus of Yotet, which is Vayikra Yotet, which is the central chapter, the climactic section of Sefer Vayikra, the chorus is Ani Hashem, Ani Hashem, Ani Hashem. What's the point of this? Why does God have to keep saying Ani Hashem, Ani Hashem? All these injunctions in Vayikra Yotet, whether they are interpersonal, whether they are about loving the stranger and loving a fellow Israelite, or whether they're of a more ritual nature, it all goes back to that relationship with God. And so we see this idea affirmed in Sefer Devarim that you have to both love God and love the neighbor as an affirmation of this relationship. And I want to put all of that aside because I want to focus on a transition that takes place in the Second Temple period. So in the Torah, again, we see two different kinds of love, but they're connected. You love the stranger, and that kind of love is empowering. We take the initiative and we love God as recipients, almost as passive recipients of the covenantal relationship. But both of these loves are affirmations of the covenant. Now, reasons for love are very important in the Torah because these loves, again, are counterintuitive. We would not instinctively think about God as an entity that requires our love or that is somehow lacking because God is all powerful and somehow needs our love. It's a counterintuitive idea. How can it be that you have this all powerful God who somehow desires our love? And likewise, but in a very different way, the love for the stranger is counterintuitive because strangers are threatening and destabilizing. Now, something different happens in the Second Temple period, and that is that the reasons fall away. And so as Jews start talking about Jewish values and ethics and what it means to act as a Jew, to think as a Jew, no longer do we see the justification for interpersonal love being based on the covenantal relationship. Interpersonal love becomes an ethic. It becomes a value that requires no justification. In fact, I think that Jewish writers in the late Second Temple period are a little bit uncomfortable with this idea that you should be nice to outsiders because God once was nice to you when you were an outsider. Instead, there's a turn away from that notion and an emphasis on the idea that, no, we love other people, whether they're in our community or not, because we value the ethic of kindness and love. And that, again, does not require any kind of justification that goes back to the relationship between Israel and God. So I want to show you a few examples from late Second Temple Jewish literature that highlight the ethic of universal love. And you might think that some of these texts don't even seem Jewish. They're very generalized. And indeed, they're very influenced by Hellenistic thinking, by Stoic ideas regarding universal love and harmony. And so you'll see, again, please try to hold off on the questions. And we are commend to love our neighbor. I just discussed that. So I promise you, I will address many of your questions. So you can put your questions in later in the hour. So the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs is a collection of speeches that are written in the late Second Temple period, probably by Jewish writers or one Jewish writer. And these speeches imagine what the children of Yaakov, of Jacob, the 12 tribes, what they said to their children on their deathbeds. And the Testament genre is a very popular genre in the ancient world. Imagining what famous people said on their deathbeds is another way of saying, what is the final word? What is the final legacy that these people left to their children? What were their central messages? And so we have the Testaments of the 12 Patriarchs. And by the way, even though it was transmitted and circulated in Greek, we have proto-testaments, fragments written in Aramaic, found in the Dead Sea caves that seem to be older versions of some of these testaments. So at Qumran, where the Dead Sea caves the Dead Sea scrolls were discovered, we have Aramaic fragments that are part of the Testament of Naphtali or the Testament of Levi. And then what we think happened is that these texts, which were produced in Hebrew and Aramaic, were later translated into Greek, and they survived in Greek. But the compositional history of this collection is very complicated, and ultimately it does enter into Christian circulation, and for many centuries this is considered a Christian collection, but I don't read this as Christian literature. We could, again, talk about that at the end of the hour. The Testament of Reuven, though, as he's telling his children how to act after his death and how to treat one another, he says, I call to witness the God of heaven that you do the truth, each to his neighbor, right? This is so similar to Vayikra Yotet, that you so love each to his brother. Zivulun says the same thing. Do not harbor resentment, my children. Love one another. And again, this appears over and over, really in all of the Testaments. Dan says, love Hashem, love one another. And so here you see a juxtaposition of these two values of loving other people and also loving God. And in the Testament of God, Gimel Dalid, not G-O-D, we have the same juxtaposition. And here, love your brothers, love one another in deed and word. The pshat, the plain translation here would be that God is telling his children to love their siblings and cousins, but the broader context really suggests that you are to love all people, right? All those around you. Okay, and on and on and on. You can look at the Testament of Yosef, of Binyamin. It's the same thing over and over. The book of Enoch likewise highlights the importance of this value, but you never really see a reason, right? Whereas in the Torah, it's you love the ger, ki geirim hayitim be'eretz Mitzrayim. And why do you love God? Because I took you out of Egypt. And here, no, it's an ethic. It's a value. Jews who are identifying as Jews have a certain set of values that depend on this central idea. Okay, and then I even included a very sectarian document. I don't know if there's such thing as a very sectarian document, but a phrase from a document found in the Damascus document, found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where, again, even in a sectarian document, we are told that, and, you know, to love everyone, his brother as himself. I don't think that that's an amazing translation. To strengthen the hand of the poor, lachzik biyad ani ve'avyon. And then there's a reference again to the ger, lidrosh ishet shalom achiyu. Okay. So why is this happening? Why do we have a transition from mandates in the Torah that tell us you have to love the ger, you have to love God? Those are interconnected. Why? Because God took you out of Egypt. To many, many late Second Temple Jewish documents that highlight these values, but seem to be uncomfortable saying, and here's why. The reason why you have to be nice to the ger and love others is because God took you out of Egypt. Why do we have that reason fall away? I'm going to just stop my share. Oh, there's something else in the chat. Okay. All right. So why does it fall away? So here's one suggestion. And I'm just going to stop my share because I use any opportunity I can to say hello to everybody. By the first century CE, there is an extraordinary amount of anti-Judaism and anti-Jewish literature being produced. And this literature is very well known to Jews. Really beginning in the third century BCE, Egyptian priests like Manetho, we'll meet him in a minute, and Greek philosophers, not all, but some, and Roman orators, they're all developing tropes about the Jewish people that essentially complain about Jewish insularity. Because by the first century, Jews are separatists, even those who are full citizens of the Roman Empire, even those who really desire to socially integrate into their host culture, even those who live in Rome and Antioch and Alexandria, these very cosmopolitan cities, and these Jews are getting philosophical educations and they're rising the ranks of political office. Even those Jews are being critiqued as outsiders because by definition, to identify as a Jew and to observe as a Jew meant that you could not fully participate in the Hellenistic world. You were using a different calendar. You were adopting a 7-day work week, which was unheard of in the Roman world. You were stopping to work every 7 days, which made no sense to the Romans. And of course, you were observing certain laws that your average, or maybe I would say your upper middle class average Greek or Roman would have thought to have been very barbaric. And so the three main identifying markers of Jewish practice, Shabbat, Brit Milah, and Kashrut, these are all separatist acts. By observing the Shabbat and the holidays, Jews are making a statement that they adhere to a separate calendar, and the calendar was of huge significance in the ancient world when it came to identifying as the in-group. So rather than going to the festival of Dionysus or the festival in the Roman period of Jupiter, the Jews are not going to these festivals. They're keeping their own festivals. They're making pilgrimages to Jerusalem. They have a whole different set of holidays. And by observing circumcision, by practicing circumcision on their sons, they're adhering not to a unique practice, because there were other cultural communities in the ancient world who practiced circumcision. But those communities were considered by Greeks and Romans to be very backwards. And so, for example, we have a lot of sources which tell us that Egyptians in very ancient times did practice circumcision. But for Greeks and Romans who looked down on the Egyptians, that was not considered something to brag about. You're affiliating with these Egyptians who engage in a barbaric practice. That doesn't make you one of us, because you are you are doing something that makes your body permanently imperfect. And with dietary laws, likewise, the Jews are staying home. They're not buying the same meats as those around them. And so you start to have very blatant criticism against the Jewish people beginning the third and second century BCE that criticize them for being misanthropic. And I've said many times before, but I'll say it again. This comes from the Greek word misanthropia, anti-people, and it's specifically associated with Jews during this period. So I guess now again, I will share my screen. And again, I will ask you, do you see my notes or do you see the story sheet? No, I think that you see my story sheet, right? Thank you, Susanna. Egyptian, Greek, and Roman accusations of Jewish hatred. So let's look
at
it.
Can you make it a little bigger though?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for asking that. There we go. How's that?
That's good.
Okay. So now we have Josephus's work. It's called Against Appian. This is the first systematic defense of the Jewish religion to have ever been produced in the ancient world. It's 2 volumes. It's very historically valuable to us because in order for Josephus to defend Judaism, he has to refute his opponents, his rhetorical opponents. And in order to refute his opponents, he cites everything that they're saying about Jews. So again, to produce a compelling defense of Judaism at the end of the first century, you need to say what everyone is saying about you. And we find patterns. And again, those patterns all boil down to the notion that Jews rejected, which was that Jews are not good team players. And so Josephus cites, I think that he's a third century Egyptian priest, Manetho. Josephus cites the Egyptian priest Manetho, who wrote about the Jews in a very antagonistic way. Remember, he's Egyptian and he knows that the stories that, Jews are circulating are about their redemption from this, this region. And so Manetho has no love for the Jewish people, and Josephus cites Manetho as saying that according to the Jews' scriptures, they are not allowed to worship the animals that are especially sacred in Egypt, and they kill them and they eat them, so that's considered horribly insulting, and they can only sleep with members of their own confederacy. And again, that's considered misanthropic, that they're not marrying those outside of their tribe. And Manetho, you can see this in Against Appian, goes on and on and on, all the ways in which the Jews think that they're better, but truly are inferior. Now, one of my favorite stories that Josephus cites is a story that I've taught many, many times. So this might be review for a lot of you because I've shared this story so many times, but it is a delightful and horrific story. And some of you might be familiar with the trope of the blood libel, which is generally thought to have its origins in the medieval period, where in England, beginning with William of Norwich, there was accusations circulating against the Jews that they would have to ritually murder a Christian and use the blood of that murdered Christian, often an innocent child, to make their matzah. And Magda Teeter, by the way, has written a wonderful book on blood libels, and she just came out like literally just now. I think within, or I don't even know if it's out, maybe it's only available for pre-order, but Magda Teeter just came out with a new book on anti-Semitism. But when I show you this source, I think I can make a compelling argument that blood libels actually precede medieval Europe, because what Josephus is about to share with us is, in a sense, a blood libel. And this is the story that's circulating about Jews that Josephus cites, and he attributes it to a Roman scholar from the first century BCE named Appian. And Appian says that there was a story circulating about the Jews at this time that many people believed. And the story is that what was happening in the Jerusalem temple, nobody knew, because non-Jews were not allowed to enter into the sanctum. But there were stories and guesses and speculation that the Jews worshiped the head of a donkey. They worshiped that animal. And here's a story that tells us the circumstances in which this fact was discovered. Oh, a formal book launch at Fordham. Oh, okay, thank you. All right, and I don't know Nixon 7. I don't accept any sports illusions in my teachings. So here's the story by which the Gentiles found out that the Jews worship the head of a donkey. In the time of the Hasmonean rebellion against the Syrian Greeks, between 167 and 164 BCE, and also earlier, Antiochus Epiphanes. So Antiochus Epiphanes is the Syrian Greek king who gains control of Judea in around, his father does actually, Antiochus III, gains control of Judea in around 200 BCE. And then the son, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, issues very oppressive legislation against the Jews years later, maybe in around 175, and he begins to prohibit the observance of Shabbat and circumcision, dietary law. And then we all know the famous story, the Hasmoneans organize a militia and they rebel, and they somehow shockingly achieve, after a three-year war, they achieve independence in 164 BC. But during the time that the temple is under Antiochus's control, this is what they find. Antiochus goes into the temple and he finds a couch in the temple on which a man is reclining. And there are these beautiful, beautiful tables with just this huge gala, this massive banquet of food. So Antiochus goes in, and what does he see in the temple? A banquet of fish of the sea, beasts of the earth, birds of the air. And this poor fellow is tied up on the couch, gazing at the food in stupefaction. And he hails the king's entry with adoration. Oh my God, thank goodness you're here, the man on the couch says to Antiochus. And he falls at the king's knees. This is the logistical challenge. Wait, I thought you were bound to the couch had you fall at the knees, but maybe he's very flexible. And he stretches that his right hand and he implores him, set me free. And the king assures him, like, oh my God, who are you? Why are you here? What is the meaning of this abundant fare? And with sighs and tears, the man in his pitiful tone, is very Hellenistic, tells Antiochus the story. And he says, and this is all being retold by the first century BC scholar Appian. And he says to Antiochus, I was a Greek and I was traveling about just looking for a livelihood, doing my thing. And suddenly men of a foreign race, Jews, kidnapped me and they conveyed me to the temple. And there he was shut up and he was seen by nobody and he was fattened. This is like a, what's the children's tale? Hansel and Gretel. Right? Is it Hansel and Gretel where they're fattened up and then the kids are eaten or almost eaten? So this man is fattened on feasts of the most lavish description. At first, these unlooked for attentions deceive him and cause him pleasure. Like, oh, okay, this is nice. I mean, I can't leave, but at least I get like a really good cheese sandwich or whatever. And then a suspicion follows. But wait a second, I can't leave. Actually, maybe this is not a good thing. And then consternation. And then he asks the guards who are watching him and they tell him the unutterable law of the Jews for the sake of which he's being fed. Why is he being fed? The practice was repeated annually at a fixed season, such a sinister sentence. The Jews would kidnap a Greek foreigner, fatten him for a year, convey him to the woods, slaughter him, sacrifice his body with their customary ritual, partake of his flesh. They ate the flesh. By the way, this was not a rare accusation against the Jews. We have a number of ancient texts from this period, from Roman writers who accused the Jews of cannibalism. And I think you find in Dio Cassius as well. And then while immolating the Greek, they swear an oath of hostility to the Jews. And at the end of the day, this is the word I want you to focus on, hostility. The Jews are hostile. They might look like us. They might live among us. They might even be socially and politically and culturally integrated into our societies, but they are not like us. They are not loyal to us. Do not trust them. And then the remains of their victim was thrown into a pit. So this is the story that's going around about the Jews that makes its way to Josephus, and Josephus absolutely tears Appian apart, and I highly recommend you reading Josephus's takedown of Appian if you have the chance. But there are so many stories that are going around in the first century that present the Jews as pariahs and as social threats. And so if this is resonant, because we know of similar, you know, libels today, these things were happening 2,000 years ago. Josephus cites Apollonius Molon and Lysimachus and many others who accuse the Jews of being atheists. I don't even understand how the Jews could be atheists. Atheists, you know, comes from no godlessness. It's a Greek word. But I guess they did not trust the Jews because the Jews rejected their own pantheon. And they're misanthropes, right? They're anti-people, et cetera, et cetera. Were barbarians and have contributed no useful invention to civilization. And so what do we make of all this? Josephus is not the only one who's very sensitive to the accusations against the Jews. And so I think if you read these accusations concurrently with the growing emphasis on interpersonal love as an ethic, right? Not we love one another because God helped us out in Egypt centuries ago, but we love one another because it's a value that requires no further justification. You could really understand that some of these texts that I showed you, not all of them, but some of these texts, especially the Testaments, I think, are really on the defensive, especially when they're circulating in Greek and outsiders have access to them. But there's something else that begins to happen in the end of the Second Temple period that I think is very striking. It's not only that Jews at this time say loving other people is an ethic and is not necessarily all about our covenantal obligation to God, but there seems to also emerge a new kind of love. Again, in the late Second Temple period, that has nothing to do with, I'm not gonna say nothing, but is not immediately about God. And it's not immediately about loving the ger or loving all people. Instead, the object of this kind of love is the Torah. Now you see hints of this in the Tanakh. The most explicit hint that I could find is from Tehillim, Ma'ahavti Torahtecha, Ko Hayom Hisichati. But you really don't find a predominant emphasis on loving Torah until the Second Temple period and the late Second Temple period. And love of Torah is framed as a loving of learning. And so Jews are not merely supposed to read the Torah, interpret the Torah, connect to the Torah, but it has to have an emotional dimension. And you see this emphasized again in late Second Temple period texts, and as we will see in early rabbinic texts as well. And so if you look at Ben Sira, Ben Sira is a document. It was written in Hebrew in the early second century BCE in the land of Israel. And then it was translated by the writer's grandson into Greek at the end of the second century BCE. You see an introduction in Ben Sira, which explicitly states that the document you are going to read is meant for those who love learning. Now, I love this little text. I want to spend some time on it because it's fascinating for many reasons, including the fact that it sheds some light on Israel diaspora relations in antiquity, and I'm writing a book on that subject. So Ben Sira, again, was translated into Greek by the author's grandson, and that grandson wrote an introduction. Doesn't exist in the Hebrew. It only exists in the grandson's translation. He wrote an introduction that explains, it's very short, that explains why he was translating this work into Greek. And he says, I'm specifically doing it for the Jews who live in Egypt. And this is just a part of that part of that introduction. He says, those who read the scriptures must not only themselves understand them, but must also, as lovers of learning, philomathes, be able, through the spoken and written word, to help the outsiders. And what we're going to see is this theme of helping outsiders through the teachings of the Torah, and at the same time, being loyal to God. And so you see both of these strains that we found in earlier texts, loving God and loving outsiders, are both encompassed within this realm of Torah. My grandfather, Yehoshua or Yeshua, they wouldn't have been saying Jesus. That's just the translation of the Greek. Mm. My grandfather, Yeshua, had devoted himself to the reading of the Torah and the Nevi'im and all the other books. And it could be that he says all the other books because the third section of Tanakh at this early stage was not considered on the same level as Torah Nevi'im, and maybe it was even considered open. And I'm not being a heretic. I have good grounding on which to say that we have rabbinic texts that debate what goes in that third section of Tanakh and what shouldn't go in. And so we know that there's certainly, even in the second century, questions about what goes into that third section. The Torah and the Nevi'im are set. We know that from many texts by the first century, those are sort of closed. But I think this is a great little historical nugget that he doesn't have a name for the Ketuvim for that third section of Tanakh. He just says, my grandfather was devoted to reading the Torah in Greek. That is nomos, but it really is a word for Torah, the prophets and the other books, whatever. They're going to be the Ketuvim. And maybe some books he thought belonged in the Ketuvim that are not in the Tanakh. We don't know. And my grandfather was very proficient in these books and was himself led to write something, this book pertaining to instruction and wisdom, so that by becoming familiar with his book, so by reading my grandfather's book, those who love learning will make even greater progress in living according to the Torah. And so this is a book for those who love the Torah. Loving the Torah, it's a new concept. Where do we find in Tanakh, besides this little pasuk, this idea of loving the Torah? I don't know of such a source, but this is an idea that becomes ever more prominent. And the Torah as a concept becomes something that is a mediating entity between the people's relationship with God and their relationship with the physical world. It both informs how one should live in the world and interact with others and how one should interact with God. You see a contemporaneous text that also uses the same word, philomathes, it's the same word. This is the letter of Aristeas. It's a document produced by a Jewish person in Alexandria, again, late second century BCE. This is the oldest source that we have regarding the circumstances in which the Hebrew Torah, just the first five books, and then later the rest, the Pentateuch, the Torah, was translated into Greek into what would become known as the Septuagint. Now, we have the story in the first century writings of Philo, and we have the story in the writings of the Gemara. But the letter of Aristeas is special because it's the oldest account that we have. And Philo almost certainly had the letter of Aristeas or a record very, very similar to it. We don't know what the rabbis were reading, but the tradition was very powerful that 6 or 7 centuries later, they're, you know, writing it down, excuse me. So the letter of Aristeas, again, which recalls the circumstances in which the Torah is written and translated into Greek, also has a translation, an introduction. And the writer's introduction emphasizes, like Ben-Sira's grandson, that the book that he is producing is specifically for those who love Torah. So he's entering into an authoritative tradition. He's not saying I'm producing Torah or I'm writing a book that I want to become part of the Tanakh, but he's paying homage to an authoritative scriptural tradition and participating in that tradition. Again, I don't think that he's thinking, oh, I'm going to write a text and it'll be part of Tanakh, but he's writing for those who love the Torah, who love the learning of the Torah. So he says to the audience, I've attempted to drop a clear exposition of the matter of this, of the story of the translation for you, for I perceive that you possess a natural love of learning, a quality which is the highest possession of man. And we see this word again, oh no, that's improperly transliterated because that V is actually supposed to be a nu. So I have to put that into Helena font so that you'll, whatever, I made a mistake with that, but that V is, think of the Greek letter. So it's philomathean. But yes, you see this word, lovers of learning, and it's specific to the learning, the study of the Torah. And we see the same thing in the late first century to Baruch. Those who love the Torah thrive, and those who do not perish. Now, what does this all mean when we enter into the rabbinic period? Loving the Torah becomes a very foundational idea in early rabbinic writings. And I'm going to just draw from Mishnah Avot to demonstrate that. In Avot, the love of Torah leads to other laws. It's all encompassing. When you love Torah, you actually ultimately experience organically love of God and love for others. And so we're sort of killing two birds with one stone. I don't like that metaphor, but we're arguing against outsider accusations of Jewish misanthropy. The Jewish law, the Torah, makes you better on an ethical plane. It teaches you universal love. But it's also, of course, an affirmation of the covenantal promises of God that were given to the people of Israel so many centuries earlier. And so we read in Avot that Hillel said, be like the students of Aharon. There's very interesting polemics here. Aharon being a priest, but he's being presented as a kind of rabbinic figure, someone who is Ohev Shalom, Rodev Shalom, Ohev et HaBriot, loving all creatures and one and the same in the act of loving all creatures, bringing them close to Torah, because closeness to Torah generates loving creatures and so on and so forth in this cycle. And we have also in the final chapter of Avot, we have this notion that studying the Torah and immersing oneself in the Torah generates a deepness, a connection, a love, both for God and for all creatures, not just the Jewish people. So there's a universality to this experience, even as it's a covenantal entity. The Torah exists to affirm this special relationship. But Rabbi Meir teaches us that anyone who immerses himself in the Torah, it's not simply about being part of this insular group of Jews and cultivating this personal connection that's exclusive to the Jews. But no, such a person is called an Ohev et HaBriot. There's something that impacts your relationship with all creatures when you study the Torah. You are both lover of God and you are lover of creatures. And we have this beautiful statement a few Mishnayot later, where we're told that the Torah is niknet, the Torah is acquired or obtained with 48 things, and we have this long list. And among those things is, again, that when you love Torah, you automatically enter into the state of love of God and love of the creatures around you. And so I hope that in the past 45 minutes or 50 minutes, I've shown or I've traced this development of what it means to love as we see it in the Torah, where it's deeply covenantal, and the rabbis who bring us full circle back into that covenantal love. The particularist and the universalist aspects of this love are never in these sources, never in tension. They're not in tension with one another. They are correlative, and the ways that Jews in the Second Temple period and the rabbinic period demonstrate that the universality and the particularity of this love are not in tension is different, but the message is the same. And that is, being part of this covenantal community brings us into deeper relationship with those around us. Thank you very much. And I do think that we have time for a couple questions. I guess I could look at the chat now. But why don't we just have a conversation? We're not such a big group. Are there any questions or comments?
Yeah, the what you were talking about at the beginning, the 12 patriarchs and their adjuration of their children to love everybody, would you consider that kind of an early ethical will?
Oh, an ethical will. That's fascinating. I actually never heard that phrase applied to the Testament literature. I mean, that's a really nice idea. And I will just say that there are so many Testament texts circulating at this time, but they're not all Jewish. You have also the Testament of Abraham, the Testament of Yitzchak. I don't know about the Testament of Yaakov. I've seen the Testament of Shlomo, but there are also Testament texts outside of the Jewish tradition. And yes, these are highly ethical. The genre is highly ethical. So yeah, it's a nice connection to the ethical will. I guess so. Good question. Someone says, and I'll go to someone who's just about to speak. The gear is often mentioned with the orphan and the widow. I've mentioned this in previous classes. So Mark says, I thought that's because they're friendless and their existence is precarious. And more than that, they're not just friendless, they're manless. So we're dealing with a patriarchal society where to be part of a stable community, you needed a husband or a father to sort of produce that social bedrock of stability. But if you don't have a father or a husband, then you're vulnerable. This is just the reality of the times. You're vulnerable to the charity and the protection of the community. And so dozens and dozens of times, the Torah tells us, you need to take proactive measures to protect those vulnerable members of the community. I don't think that's undermining at all what I've been saying in this hour. I think you're absolutely right, Mark. But the reason given for that protection is because God protected you when you were a ger. So yes, they are vulnerable, but there's a justification that's given in Shemot, in Devarim. That justification falls out in the Second Temple period, because their Jews want to show, no, we just love because we love, right? Because we're good people, gosh darn it. And not because we have any motive, God made us. It's like, as a kid, you might give your friend some of your cookies, but that's because your mom, this is a horrible example, but your mom is whispering in your ear, like, give Sammy a cookie. So that's not, that makes you a little bit less pious. If someone's whispering to your ear, you better do it or else. All right. So was there another comment or a question?
Yes. Are these testaments, are they the same as the Toldot or the Megillot of the brothers, where they tell, wherein this, like, there are elaborations on this, there's the stories of their lives, what they did with their wives and their kids? And
but as far as I've never heard them referred to as Megillot. So I would have to know more. Maybe send me an email.
So maybe they're not Megillot, but there's something, because Yaakov Beasley was talking about the something of Reuven, and he said it's a whole, all the 12 tribes had these.
Probably, I don't know the Hebrew scholarship lexicon for this collection, mm-hmm. but it wouldn't be Megillah. I mean, I would be very surprised. If it was
right, Megillah. But
it would make sense.
Right, so there can't be two different sets of things about that the 12 tribes in this Greek, record period. it, what you're talking about is what he's probably talking about.
I am 95% sure of that.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Any other questions? I always give my email at the end of my class. If you have any thoughts or you need some time to ruminate over or what we just discussed, so you can all reach me at msimkovich@ctu.edu. I'm sorry if I was a little snarky about the comments at the beginning of the hour. I don't want anyone's feelings to be hurt. If I did not address your comment properly, don't hesitate to send me an email. And if I don't hear from you, have a wonderful Shavuot, a Chag Sameach, and be well. Thank you.
Thank you, Malka. Exciting as ever.
Oh, thank you.